So, welcome to your first class of 2019 on the question of women in the United States. And so, you probably know a little bit about this subject. So I'm going to go back to around the beginning of the 19th century and bring us up little by little through the main, fairly introductory, through the main stages of what happened. First of all, a couple of symbols from today. Do you know what this is? Yeah. What was it called? Yeah, a pussy hat. Yeah, a pussy hat. Yeah, and it became. What did it become a symbol of?
Women's March.
Yeah, and in particular. Yeah, that's right. The Women's March last year. Yeah, around the Me Too hashtag and so on and so forth. And we have a couple of more pictures from the Women's March, January 2017. Quite historic, the biggest Women's March that we'd seen for a good time. And this included a certain number of placards and slogans, like these. What's the one right just in the middle there? Pussies grab their rights back. Okay. And in particular, slogans against Donald Trump, build the wall around Trump. We will fight to protect reproductive rights our mothers won. A most admirable sentiment, but not a very poetic writer of slogans. More poetic, my favourite slogan, without Hermione, Harry would have died in book one. I think it had a certain style then. And I'd even prefer Voldemort's. Yeah. Okay. He whose name shall not be spoken. He whose name shall not be spoken. Okay, so going back a couple of hundred years, and I will see if I can try to make it come to life a little bit. But first of all, I think I have a little quiz. In what year did women in the United States win the right to vote? Would you like to guess? It's not really a test. Have a go. 1930. Who thinks it was before 1930? Who thinks it was after 1930? Who thinks they don't have the vote yet? Okay, the correct answer is 1920. Okay. Yeah, that's absolutely correct there. Which was the first state to grant the vote in presidential elections? Remember that the states decided individually. This is a very federal system in the United States. Which was the first state to grant women the vote? Yeah, there are too many states. You have no idea, do you?
No.
Okay, well, unfortunately, I've forgotten, but it's on the next slide. Okay. Why were women arrested and force-fed in prison in 1917? It was for picketing the White House. When the 19th Amendment was finally passed by the US Congress, it was passed with a margin, I think you can guess, how many votes? One vote. Yeah, one vote. In which year did English women get the vote? Before the Americans or after the Americans? After, before, at the same time. Okay, now it is a slightly difficult question because it depends. Women over 30 got the vote in 1918 when men over 21 could vote. And women got the same voting rights as men in 1928. So it's in two parts. It's in two parts.
44.
Thank you. 1944. Okay. Did you know? Good. Did you know you could vote? Okay. But here you get the answers. 1920, the first state to give women the vote in presidential elections, Wyoming. Of course, The protest was the cause, the Women's Party. The margin of victory for the 19th Amendment, which said you all women must have the vote. In Britain, it was 1918, 1920, 1928, and in France, it was 1945. Remember, when you have reforms, quite often you have the presentation of a law, the voting of a law, and then the application of a law. So it's normal that there's 1 year between them. You know, that's not so surprising. Okay, so if we go back to the 19th century, the three big events which are going to affect women's rights: the Revolutionary War, which will win independence from Britain. This is the war where you have the Boston Tea Party and the gunshot that echoed around the world and things like that. And they win. The Americans win and the British lose. Although they don't seem to be too worried, the British losing. They lose the United States, so they go and take India instead. It was that kind of place, you know. This will change the situation for women, as wars often have done in this century, because many of the men are away from home, the economy needs to be run by women, and this does make a difference. The biggest difference after the Revolutionary War is probably that there was more possibility for women from the elite to get education. But fundamentally, the whole thing about women's rights tends to be the right to vote, right to education, and the right to control, to decide the number of children you have. These are the three big ones. And they're all a little more complicated, because of course with the right to vote, you can have the right to vote in local elections, in national elections, in presidential elections, at what age, etc. And in education, yeah? The first one and the third one, the right to vote and the right to control how many children you have, can sometimes give rise to mass movements. Sometimes they can interest women from all classes. However, in the 19th century, the 18th century, the right to education really only interested the elites, because the ordinary people, nobody had education, men or women, so you couldn't really get a mass movement to fight for the right for women to go to university, because most people didn't know anybody who'd been to university. Yeah? So it's a slightly different, the education one, but that's the one that changed the most after the Revolutionary War. There was more right for women to go to education. Now, I think it's important to understand what are the ideas behind the restrictions, because the reason that women do not have the right to education before is because the general opinion of the elite is that women have nothing in their head, and so they cannot benefit from education. So it's not just a law, it's not just a question of rights, it's also a question of the social representation of women. And this is why the right to vote becomes so symbolic, because of course, you know, we have the right to vote, and sometimes we vote and sometimes we stay at home. But when women did not have the right to vote, that was because the general social ideology imposed is that women cannot think, and therefore don't have the right to vote. And that's why, in many ways, the right to vote is much more important than the fact that you vote every... because it's a representation of what women are. The second huge war, 80 years later, the Civil War, between the North and the South. The South, the more agricultural states, absolutely dependent on slavery for sugar, for cotton, and so on. The North, the more industrial states who worked, saw the future much more in terms of free labour and not slavery. And of course, the moral and ethical conflicts around these. Now, the Civil War was not only fought over slavery, but that was one of the most important changes that came out. And again, this will give much more... this will give an enormous boost to campaigns for women's rights, and in particular the right to vote, because after the Civil War, black men will get the right to vote, and this will cause a lot of upset and controversy. And finally, the First World War. Notice the dates for America. You know, the dates for the United States are different from the dates we have over in Europe. Now, in some ways, it's a little sad to think that, you know, only enormous tragic events really make a difference, but then that's where you go. Now, if we go to the 19th century, one of the big social events which will boost the desire for women to have rights is the Second Great Awakening. Does anybody know what the Second Great Awakening is? It's a religious movement. Now, again, this is something which where we need to become a little bit historical, because today we normally think of religion is over here and politics is over there. However, this is not the case in the past. Certainly in the 16th and 17th century, in Britain, for example, religion and politics are the same thing. That is to say, if you say, I want radical changes in society, the normal thing to say in the 17th century is, God wants radical changes in society. That would be the normal way of seeing the world, yeah? You can't separate them out. So it becomes an argument about what does God want and how do we know what God wants. Now, in the 19th century, it's more an intermediate situation where not all politics is religious, but still a tremendous amount of politics is religious. The Great Awakening is a revival. It's an increase in religious activity in America based on Protestant evangelism. That is a very very dynamic meetings, lots of singing, lots of individual involvements. When the people went from Europe over to America to colonize, it was easier for them to be Protestant than Catholic, because the thing about being a Catholic is you need to know what the priest thinks, and the priest needs to know what the bishop thinks, and the bishop needs to know what the Pope thinks. And so when you're in America and it's 3 weeks to get a message to Europe, that's not very good, yeah? And so the ideal kind of religion for the United States, well, not the United States, for America, was this new Protestant idea that what matters is your relationship with God. Priests, bishops, that's not so important. There's you and God and the Bible. And of course, the advantage of the Bible over the Pope is that you can carry the Bible with you in your ship, and not the Pope, because he's busy. So you've got this from 1801. For 50 years, you had this revivalism, this spiritual reform from within, a strong emphasis on what we call pietism. That is, what is important is not, are you a good person? It's, do you believe? Yeah, this is called pietism. Faith is at the center. And this led to... this led to a desire for some social reforms. In fact, quite a section of the Great Awakening religious people believed Jesus is going to come again soon and we need to reform society to be ready. Okay, that kind of idea. Now, this doesn't sound very close to women's rights, but as we have seen recently, if you start saying we need social change, then lots of people start thinking, we could have some other social changes as well. For example, there was an enormous campaign for temperance, that is to reduce the consumption of alcohol. Now today we tend to, in general, I think certainly in France, we tend to think, why campaign against alcohol? It has to be said, at the time, this was, you know, like litres and litres of whiskey. You know, this was really very serious. Alcohol was a very serious public health problem. I mean, it still is in some ways. But you have to imagine it being a little bit like campaigning against cocaine or heroin. The number of people who died from alcohol in the 19th century was absolutely massive. Absolutely massive, you know. The amount of drinking went down throughout the 19th century. So the temperance campaigns were very varied. They were not always conservative. In Britain, for example, there were important socialist temperance campaigns for the 19th century. Campaigns to reform the prisons. The prisons, this is Jean Valjean, you know, that kind of prison, you know, breaking things. And all of these were linked with the religious campaigns. One of the most important, abolitionism, in order to abolish what? Slavery, yes, slavery. The big campaign to abolish slavery. And this will very, very slowly be successful, first of all, in Europe, and then later in America. So, for example, after 1807, I think, the slave trade is abolished in the British Empire, and in 1833, slavery is abolished in the British Empire. In France, you abolish slavery and then bring it back. Now, the French Revolution abolishes slavery, then Napoleon brings it back. And then I think it's 1848, the second abolition. But in America, of course, it's still continuing in the 1840s, 1850s, lots and lots of slavery, especially in the South. So abolitionism, again, linked to religion. That people think Jesus is coming again, so we need to make social justice in order to be ready. It's not a very modern idea, but it was a very, very popular idea at the time. And also, in all of this, came, you know, women's rights. It could be linked to a religious view of the world, and various forms of education. How can we improve society and improve society through improving individuals and what they're like? So this is the first. This is the context, if you like, this desire for change linked to the idea that we need to be new religiously, and it might be that that Jesus is coming again. This is more of the same. One of the big characteristics of the Great Awakening is the camp meetings, enormous religious meetings. This is very new. In France at the time, in Italy at the time, it's the village church. 100 people. If you have 200 people, you need two churches. Whereas the camp meetings, you know, let's have 1,000 people, let's have 2,000 people. The pietism, that is the centrality of what do you believe? That's what matters. Not are you good, are you bad? That's not so important. What do you believe? And this is this. You can still see this today in evangelical Christianity. It's in, do you accept a personal relationship with Jesus? This is the centre of evangelical reality. Evangelism and circuit riders. They sent missionaries around from town to town. Riders, yeah, on a horse. And this was important because for the first time, you had women going from town to town to recruit people to religion. This gave them much more freedom than they were used to having, yeah? You ride around from town to town. And so, in fact, quite a number of women who liked the idea of being independent, said, oh, you know, I'll be a missionary, yeah. It had sections. Millenarianism is simply the idea that Jesus is coming again soon. Yeah, millenarianism is the idea Jesus is coming again soon. Whereas it's a little bit more complicated than that, the theology. It's very interesting, the theology. It's a little bit more complicated. And again, there were large numbers of women's prayer groups. That is to say, this was a movement where women had a full role. Because remember that in politics, talking about society in politics, if you have a group of people to dinner and you're a man and you're going to discuss politics, you say, ladies, will you leave, please? We're going to discuss politics. Yeah? Whereas in here, you have the idea that, yeah, women have the right to have women's prayer groups and so on. But what, behave yourself. Women's prayer groups and so on. So there was a space for women within general discussing general ideas of what society should be like. But they had problems. And one of the problems they had is that, like most religious documents, you can find some extracts from the Bible which are not so liberal about what women are allowed to do. And this is the St. Paul's first letter to Timothy. This is what he says. This is the St. James translation from the 17th century, the most prestigious one. In like manner also that women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with shamefacedness and sobriety, not with broided hair or gold. I'm looking for your gold, pearls, or costly array. So number one, we don't want women to be too decorated. I'm not sure about those earrings. Secondly, good works. And then let's continue. Let the women learn in silence with all subjection, but I suffer not a woman to teach, nor to usurp authority over the man, but to be in silence. For Adam was first formed, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived by the snake, but the woman being deceived was in the transgression. Okay, so it's not looking good, yeah? That is to say, sections of the Christian religion who said, you know, every word in this Bible, we need to respect it, this caused a problem for women, because he says, yeah, women can't teach. This is St. Paul, you know, St. Paul, big man, yeah? So this was the kind of debates that were going on at the time. And these were debates which were, the people who did not agree were felt obliged to reply in a religious manner to find other sections of the Bible which seemed to say different things. Yeah, it was not possible at the time to say, oh, that's just the Bible and it's shit. No, it wasn't allowed. So, as you can imagine, in the early 19th century, there were very few, very little rights for women. You couldn't vote, were considered to be minors, children, like children. They could only own property when they were single. And once they were married, they had no control over their property. This could be a very serious situation, because among the elites, if you had problems in the marriage, you didn't divorce, you just separated. And any money the woman owned belonged to the man. Now, this was another of the big... I'm hoping that that's connected to the class in some way. I'm hoping. It is? Good. Okay. This was another of the big struggles, the right for married women to own property. Another very, very big one. Took 50 years. And again, this was a question which mattered mostly to the elites. Yeah. The ordinary women, they had no property, and the ordinary men had no property, so that was not a big deal. Yeah. But it was a very important thing among the elite. At the same time, in the 19th century, women could not initiate divorce and could not make wills or sign a contract or bring suit in court without her husband's permission. I don't think you're very surprised. At all these things. Again, don't worry if you don't get every word. This PowerPoint will be up on the blog eventually. So, situation at the beginning of the 19th century, pretty low down. In Britain, women had more rights in the 10th century than in the 18th century. It's not an automatic thing that always goes up. They had more rights in the 10th century than in the 18th century, because the old Anglo-Saxon, or sans propre, system allowed more space for women than the new feudal situation. Oh, look, it's all going to go into colour. That's art, almost. So let's have a look at a few heroines. And I just wanted to check. Je suis parti un peu de l'idée que vous n'y saviez presque rien. Est-ce que j'ai raison? Oui. Vous me rassurez. Non, mais c'est parce que vous auriez pu, c'est pas tant, mais de cependant. Donc ces gens-là, qui a entendu les noms, même? Ok, bon, c'est bien. Non, mais c'est. Oubliez-le. Sinon, je me suis dit, est-ce que c'est trop introductif? Mais non, en fait, non. Also, half of what I'm telling you, I learned last year. So, you know. So here are two of the heroines, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott. And we're going to look a little bit at the sort of things they did. Well, first of all, these two women were involved in the anti-slavery movement. They were active in the anti-slavery movement. And they went to the International Congress of Groups for the Abolition of Slavery in London. And in fact, they were chosen by their groups in America, in different towns, to represent their groups in London. And when they arrived in London, what do you think happened?
I don't remember.
Yeah. They were told, you can't come to the meeting. You can't come to the meeting because you are women. So they were elected in America to represent.
They went with their husband?
Yeah.
The group kids.
Absolutely. It's all in there somewhere. Absolutely.
That's good.
Okay. Yeah. So they had this contradictory situation where they were very determined to fight against slavery, and there were a lot of men who wanted to fight against slavery. But when they went to the conference, the men voted and said, "No, we don't want any women here." And eventually, they found a little compromise where they allowed the women to sit in a corner and listen, but not speak. So you can imagine this must have been, it's pretty humiliating. And to his great credit, I can't remember who it is, but the one man who arrived too late to vote to allow the women in, he refused to join the meeting and he went to sit with the women because he said, you know, there were some people on her side. But this was a big deal. So in 1840 there was a split in the abolitionist movement of the women's role in it, and the World Anti-Slavery Convention in 1840. So this is after the abolition of slavery in 1833 in the British Empire. And there Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton were refused entry. This is a very important moment because these are people who are activists. Yeah, they know how to organise, they know how to give meetings, they know how to give speeches, and then they're told that they can't come into the meeting. And they're not the kind of women who's going to say, "Oh, well, I'm sorry, I'll go home then," you know. And so they were fighting back. And what they did is slowly, it took them a long time, it took them a few years, they decided to organise a meeting. The first convention for women's rights in America, which was at a small town, which is not important at all in any other way, Seneca Falls. Not easy to organise a meeting. You know, most husbands would not want their wife to leave town and go to another town to a political meeting. It's a very small town atmosphere, you know. Well, if I let my wife go to a political meeting in another town, what will the neighbours think? What will they say at church? Now, this is a huge social pressure. But they did have this meeting. About 300 people went to the meeting at Seneca Falls, both men and women. Yeah, but also, I should say, both women and men. And here are some of the important people. The Grimke sisters. And the Grimke sisters were abolitionists from the South. So they lived in the South where there was slavery, but they were in favour of the abolition of slavery. This was extremely difficult in the South. All your neighbours had slaves. Yeah, you basically lost all your friends if you were for the abolition of slavery in the South at that time. These are extremely brave people. It's hard to imagine for us. And another important leader, Lucy Stone. Okay, I have a tiny little video for you about the Seneca Falls Convention. So let's have a look at that, see if I can find it first of all.
The 1848 Seneca Falls Convention was the very first women's rights convention in the United States, kicking off a decades-long struggle for gender equality. Here, we'll tell the story of the Seneca Falls Convention and its lasting legacy, a story that started with the Tea Party. And we'll get into all that in just a minute. First, we have to understand the traditional 19th century gender roles. Men dominated the public sphere by working, voting, or participating in politics, while women stayed home to cook, clean, and raise children. There were restrictions in many states on women voting, owning property, and having control of their own income. One woman who advocated for women's rights in the 19th century was Elizabeth Cady Stanton, a homemaker in Seneca Falls, New York. Born into a progressive family, Stanton grew up highly educated and enjoyed an active social and political life before settling down with a family. But Stanton felt stifled as just a wife and mother to seven children, longing for a life outside the home. She soon found it in a local group of Quaker women who embraced equality, community, and activism. They invited her to a small social gathering, a tea party, which included a Quaker activist named Lucretia Mott. Mott and Stanton had met years before at an anti-slavery convention in London, but they were denied entry due to their gender. It was during the Tea Party that Stanton lamented the injustice of a woman's unequal status in society. Her words resonated with the others. So the women decided to hold a gathering that would call attention to the social, civil, and religious rights of women, the first of its kind in the United States. It became known as the Seneca Falls Convention, taking place on July 19th and 20th, 1848, with over 300 people in attendance. Like Stanton and Mott, many in attendance were also active in the anti-slavery movement, including Frederick Douglass, a former slave and abolitionist who was one of the few men and the only African-American to attend. At the convention, they read the Declaration of Sentiments, a document drafted by Stanton and modeled after the Declaration of Independence, declaring, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal." The sentiments outlined the civil and political rights denied to American women, which included education, property ownership, child custody in the event of a divorce, and most importantly, the right to vote. On the second day of the convention, 12 resolutions were passed and signed by 68 women and 32 men. The Seneca Falls Convention was the first time that American women demanded a change, and it caused quite a stir around the country. Many newspapers mocked them with unflattering political cartoons, while columns ridiculed the convention as dull and uninteresting or insane and ludicrous. One writer declared equal rights for women to be a monstrous injury to all mankind. The wave of negative press was too humiliating for some of the participants to handle, particularly those who had signed the Declaration of Sentiments. Several went as far as withdrawing their names from the document and joining the opposition. But public shaming didn't stop the movement. The impact and promise of the Seneca Falls Convention was undeniable. Women like Elizabeth Cady Stanton felt a renewed sense of purpose and threw themselves headlong into the fight for equal rights. A month later, a second larger convention was held in Rochester with the Declaration of Sentiments gaining 107 additional signatures. The Seneca Falls Convention would signal the birth of the women's rights movement. One particular resolution in the Declaration of Sentiments would evolve into a full-fledged crusade, the demand for women's suffrage. Decades of political organizing, marches, and protests would ultimately result in the 1920 passage of the 19th Amendment, which guaranteed women the right to vote, something that couldn't have happened without the Seneca Falls Convention.
Well, that was history. Okay. She's doing my job for me. That's good. How do I stop this happening? Okay. Yes. So we see there in the video some of the pressure involved, and in particular, I'm sure you noticed they said that several people withdrew their signatures after the convention because the pressure was so enormous. The other thing to notice here or to understand here is this is 1848, and as we mentioned earlier, the right to vote at national elections is won in 1920. That is to say that most of the people who signed that convention were already dead before. I'm very impressed by the amount of patience involved in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years of campaigning. So let's have a look at the Declaration of Sentiments. Here we have a meeting. This is a recent statue, 1998 statue, commemorating the first time that three of the women's rights leaders met. I can't remember what town. You know, so just that's a recent statue. And so they haven't been forgotten. So Seneca Falls, the first women's rights movement, talking about these different questions which were mentioned in the video. One of the ones that I hadn't mentioned too much: repeal of laws awarding the father custody of the children in divorce. If you had a divorce, and this is basically only elite people who are getting divorces at this time, because it costs a lot of money. The father could keep custody of the children. Now, this was not the same kind of custody that we imagine today, because in fact, for elite children, the mother was not going to raise them anyway. It was going to be servants who were raising them anyway. But still, it was an inequality and suffrage rights. So, have a little excerpt from the Seneca Falls Declaration, which was written then by Elizabeth Cady Stanton. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So this is a quotation from the Declaration of Independence, with added, and women. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. The history of mankind is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations on the part of men towards women, having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over her. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. He has made her, if married, in the eyes of the law, civilly dead, and not having an existence in law. He has taken from all rights in property, even to the wages she earns. He has made her morally an irresponsible being, as she can commit many crimes with impunity, provided they be done in the presence of her husband. If you, one of the few advantages, if you commit a crime when your husband is there, it's his responsibility. Hey, it's got potential. It's not the case anymore. Don't do it. In the covenant of marriage, she is compelled to promise obedience to her husband, he becoming, to all intents and purposes, her master, the law giving him power to deprive her of her liberty and to administer chastisements. Okay, so those are the quotations, and indeed the law would follow that. It was almost impossible for a husband to be imprisoned for violence against his wife at this time. Almost impossible. So that was considered to be quite normal. Okay, so here we have just some of the, you don't need to learn every one of these. Here are some of the most important leaders in chronological order. So at the beginning, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who wrote the Declaration of Sentiments, Susan B. Anthony, who will be involved until the 19th Amendment passed in 1920, Jane Addams, Carrie Nation, who mostly concentrated on temperance, and we'll be talking a lot more about Margaret Sanger, who founds the American Birth Control League. This is a time when she begins, the normal thing is to have 20 children and half of them die. That's a normal thing to do. Yeah. So this is big. This is big. This was a big question, and it was of course illegal to give any advice about contraception. You could be imprisoned. The people were imprisoned, because they gave advice about contraception. This is part of a much bigger change in societies, where today more and more it is considered that there are many decisions which are individual decisions, and that it's not the government's job to make sure everybody is moral. But in the past, that was considered to be part of a government's job, to maintain the level of supposed morality. Now, Susan B. Anthony is still very much in the news, because in 2016, when Hillary Clinton was the first ever presidential candidate for a major party, women went to her gravestone and they put these little stickers, "I voted," on it, saying, thank you for winning the right to vote for women, and in homage. Would you like to have stickers on your gravestone 100 years after you died? You don't care, do you? You'll care more when you're older, when you're nearly dead. Okay. Yes. Yeah. So this is just to show that it is still, these are still people who are in the national consciousness today. So where was I there? Other important leaders, all political. This is the case in many countries, but in particular in the United States, every political question has a racial aspect. because of the history of the country. If you're studying American politics, if you're not thinking about black and white, you've understood nothing, which is not the same in Britain, because in Britain, of course, people who are not white are generally immigrants, which is not the case in America, and that's what makes the big difference. In any case, one of the great black leaders was Sojourner Truth, who was involved in the women's movement and wrote a very famous speech called Ain't I a Woman, which was a tremendously famous speech. I can't remember when. In the 1870s, probably. And this is one of her, one thing she said in 1869. There is a great stir about coloured men getting their rights after the Civil War. Firstly, slavery was abolished. And then, of course, if you are once slavery is abolished, it was still the case that in most states, black men could not vote. So obviously, the logic of abolishing slavery was to allow votes for black men. Although, even after there were votes, as you know, many states tried to avoid the law, for example, by having an exam. You had to pass an exam before you could vote, and they fixed the exam so that you can pass it if you weren't white. There is a great stir about coloured men getting their rights, and not a word about the coloured women. And if coloured men get their rights and not coloured women theirs, you see the coloured men will be masters over the women, and it will be just as bad as it was before. Now, since the abolition of slavery, you often hear in different radical campaigns, this is the same as slavery. But I think this has to be seen as a sort of hyperbolic way of expression. Because it's not the same, because when under slavery, the master could just kill the slave because they wanted to, and this was fine. Yeah. When people say, we are like slaves, that doesn't mean it's true. It's a kind of exaggeration for effect. Now, of course, one of the important things to understand about the women's rights movement is it's not an automatic progression. First of all, as I said, it takes a long time, 1848 to 1920. But also, it goes forward, it goes back, and a lot of very complicated questions are asked. And one of the biggest ones for any radical movement is, what is an acceptable compromise? Of course, you always have to compromise as you're moving forward, but what is an acceptable compromise? And one of the big questions here came when around the abolitionist movements and the women's suffrage movement, and a lot of people were in both of them, came the question of the new law, the new amendment, which was going to give votes to black men. And most people said, oh well, votes for black men is a step forward, so we need to support this amendment. But a big section of the women's movement said, no, we are opposed to this new amendment because it says black men. Yeah. And we want women. But even worse than that, of course, this is a very racist society. And so a section of the women's movement said, it's terrible. Inferior black men have the vote and superior white women do not have the vote. This just shows one of the big lessons of history. When people are heroic and correct and progressive on one question, that doesn't mean that they will be heroic and progressive on every other question. In Britain, the feminist leaders, Emmeline Pankhurst, were enthusiastic supporters of the First World War because politics is complicated. And here is an example. Sections of the women's suffrage movement felt they needed support from racist politicians in the South. So they had a bigger debate about it. Said, oh no, I don't want to work with racist politicians. If you don't work with the racist politicians, we will lose. And if you work with them, we will win. Difficult question. And this is what she said. Yeah. So certainly Susan B. Anthony and others use racist arguments. This is Susan B. Anthony. The old anti-slavery school says women must stand back and wait until the Negro shall be recognized. But we say, if you will not give the whole loaf of suffrage to the entire people, give it to the most intelligent first. If intelligence, justice, and morality are to have precedence in the government, let the question of the woman be brought up first and that of the Negro last. Yeah, so obviously, clearly racist sentiments. And this has led to a certain amount of... Je l'ai pas. Okay, so sorry, Paul, I spent 4 seconds. Contradictory elements of the movement, which are not special to the American women's movement. All radical movements have these contradictory elements where there are things they have understood and there are things they have really not understood. Okay, so nothing really terribly surprising there. The Civil War is finished. I didn't tell you much about the Civil War, but people fought and somebody won and somebody lost, you know. And 1871, you have the 15th Amendment to the American Constitution. I'm sure you remember that the Constitution in America is extremely important because the states make their own laws. Every state makes its own laws, but they are limited by the Constitution and the 15th Amendment, Section 1. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, colour, or previous condition of servitude. That means ex-slaves. So this is a completely new amendment. This means that every state is obliged to follow this. Before the amendment, some states could follow it if they wanted, and other states could not follow it if they don't want it. That's how constitutional amendments work. Notice that it doesn't say women and it doesn't say men. And one of the sharp, I think it's Susan B. Anthony or some of the others, anyway, I can't remember exactly who, but they looked at the Constitution and it says citizens. There's nothing in the Constitution written down which says that women can't vote. And so on election day, a small number of women went to and insisted, I'm voting, look, here's the Constitution. It does not say in so many words. The reason it does not say is because in the minds of the people who wrote the Constitution, this was obvious. It was not necessary to say it. And then there was a big court case, in the tribunal to say, can she vote or not? And of course, the woman lost the court case, but this was a political victory because you got it all over the news. So there you go, 1871, the 15th Amendment. Section 2 is obvious. So the 15th Amendment granted African-American men the right to vote. You'll notice that the people at the time, the quotation from the time, Sojourner Truth, she says, coloured men and coloured women. This is an expression we don't use today. Because in fact, everybody is coloured. Some people are beige and some people are pink. So using coloured as black is actually not so great. But it was normal at the time. Many women who thought African-American men and women would be enfranchised together were disappointed, of course. Disappointment is, if you're going to be involved in a radical movement, you need to be used to being disappointment. And African-Americans were split over whether men should get the vote before women. So, next generation, that means it kind of stalled in the 1870s where the big upheaval after the Civil War, completely new amendments to the Constitution, two, for one on slavery, one on the right to vote. The women's rights movement thought, if there are big changes, we will benefit from it. But in fact, that time they did not. And so This debate around the amendment giving African American men the right to vote divided the movement. Susan B. Anthony said it was campaigned against the 15th Amendment because it's only for men. Whereas another section of the movement campaigned for it, and Frederick Douglass in particular campaigned for it. And so, in fact, the movement split into two different organizations. Yeah. Again, this is very often the history of and for 20 years, the two separate organizations with a different view of how to win. And in 1890, only 20 years later, they come back together again, and we'll start having some more success. Several of these, I don't know how interested you are in American history, but Susan Anthony wrote her autobiography, which you can find free on the web, and it's quite a lot of fun. So the same people are leading. And once they reunify the movement in 1890, there are two different strategies which are being defended. One is to try to win suffrage state by state, one state at a time. Some of the states begin to give the right of women, the right to vote for women. But they're not obliged to, because if you want to oblige the states to, you need a constitutional amendment. So you need the two different strategies. Shall we concentrate on one state at a time? Shall we go to the states where we stand a good chance of winning? Or shall we go for the constitutional amendment? However, a constitutional amendment must be ratified by 3/4 of the states, which is a lot of work. So a division over what's the best way to win? What's the best way to win? This is the same, a similar question to what is an acceptable compromise. Oh, that's, you just have a membership. That's just a membership card of the National American Women's Suffrage Association. Susan B. Anthony then continuing to try to introduce an amendment. The debate continues, and this is the time of the debate in Britain as well. The British suffrage campaign in the 1870s, 1880s will have small victories. The right to vote in local elections, etc. The right to go to university, little by little. But the society was very much divided, especially at the end of the 1970s. I think the majority of people were in favour of women's voting around 1905. That's when the majority of public opinion. But before, it was a minority opinion, and the anti-suffragists had lots of arguments. Now, remember, there were organisations founded in order to oppose the to oppose the right to vote for women. Perhaps you know, but there were also organisations of women against the right to vote for women. The National Anti-Suffrage Women's Association. Yeah? That's harder for us to understand, but these kind of things existed. And these are the arguments they were going to use. Women are irrational and emotional, whereas of course men are not. Women not smart or educated enough. Women should stay at home. Women were too physically frail to vote. Mm-hmm. And women would become masculine if they voted. Some of these are difficult for us to understand. There was another big one was that at this time, of course, this is before Facebook, yeah? You got that? Before Facebook, to do politics is to go door to door, to go on knock on the door. I want to talk to you about the election. And there was a tremendous moral panic where people were worried that if women were going from door to door talking to men who are not part of their family, this would lead to a lot of immorality and promiscuity and things like that. So lots of moral structures. That's quite fun. So those are some of the arguments that were being used. This was quite wide. There were quite a number of popular songs about how ridiculous it would be for women to vote. This is in the 19th century. In the 20th century, not so much. But here is what actually happened, and you can see that slowly the right to vote for women was being won. 1869, Wyoming. 1870, Utah. This is interesting because we always imagine New York and California as being the most progressive places. Not at the time, yeah? A big pause after 1870. Big pause after 1870. 1896, Idaho. Big pause again. And then 1910, Washington. That's Washington State, of course. 1911, California. 1912, Arizona. 1970, New York. 1918, Michigan. And then all the others were behind there. Although some of the states, the ones in pink, have partial women's suffrage. This is probably the right to vote at local elections. So poor old Elizabeth Cady Stanton died before seeing women's suffrage come, as did Susan B. Anthony. But we had a new generation. In particular, there were more women, middle-class women, going to university, and so then they could get involved in that way. And you've got a wider movement involving many working-class women. This is a similar trajectory to the situation in Britain. Okay. So here are some of the next generation. Carrie Chapman Catt. You know, the Americans like to have three names. She became the new leader of the National American Women's Suffrage Association and was a supporter then of this state-by-state strategy. She also got involved in a big debate again about acceptable compromises. She said, we should support President Wilson. President Wilson is not completely in favour of women's suffrage, but the Democrats are more promising than the Republicans. Whereas I know that other people in the movement said, no, don't vote for anybody unless they support women's suffrage. So let's boycott the presidential elections. These are difficult questions of tactics. And finally, Carrie Chapman Catt was in favour of acting ladylike and not embarrassing the movement, yeah? Said, we need to show everybody that we're not masculine, that we're very ladylike. And the other wing of the movement was probably represented by Alice Paul, who formed a new political party, the National Women's Party. So you can see the logic of this. We cannot trust the Republicans. We cannot trust the Democrats. We need a National Woman's Party. Now, in many countries, there have been women's parties, not generally for very long, but it is a particular political strategy. And she had nicer hats. This is Alice Paul, then, who was focusing on, as a strategy, on passing a constitutional amendment, and took tactics from the British suffragette movements, which were more direct action. The British suffragettes in 1904 began burning letterboxes in the streets, you know, the boxes with letters on, in a time when nobody has a telephone or internet. This is very important. You can really cause a lot of problems for businesses by burning all the letterboxes, and that's what they did in Britain. Also, they smashed all the windows, all the government windows in London one day. And this is a very interesting political thing, because the British leader of the suffragettes, Emmeline Pankhurst, somebody said to her, if you break windows and burn letterboxes, you will never persuade people that you are right. And she answered, I'm not trying to persuade people. I'm trying to make political life impossible until they give women the vote. So a very interesting political debate there, that the questions of right and debate. And so Alice Paul, of course, she has an independent party. She refused to support President Wilson. And these are the people who were jailed, put in jail for picketing in front of the White House, went on hunger strike in jail. This mirrors the situation in Britain at the time. So this is really, hunger strike is no fun, and force feeding is even less fun. So these are really a more radical strategy. Now today, historians debate about which one of the strategies was successful. This is probably impossible to say. We know things happened. Why they happened is a matter of opinion. But it brings up a number of interesting debates. And finally, Oh, and here is one example of a demonstration. The march in Washington, D.C. Yes, so the capital, not the state. March the 3rd, 1913. You can see, very, very interesting image. Sort of heroic crusade. Sort of medieval crusade image. There's the official programme there. Okay. Okay, so last semester, the last part of classes will be a longer video, and I thought what we could look at. I don't know if you know, but next July in France is the World Cup for women's football. Did you know? And so I thought it'd be interesting. This is history, the history of the U.S. women's football team.
I get the sense that young players have said, you know what, in my later years, I'm going to be so proud to say I played with Mia Hamm, Julie Fowles, Christine Lilly, Brandi Chastain, and Joy Fox.